All right, let's call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record please reflect that it is 3:38 p.m. on Thursday, September 9th, 2021, and also that we have a quorum present today are Senator Stevens, Senator Von Imhoff via Zoom, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, and Senators Machicki and Bishop. Senator Machicki is here. Senator Bishop is on his way. And myself, Senator Rivak, I'd like to recognize Senator Gray Jackson joining us here and Senator Begich. Staffing the committee today are Dirk Kraft, LIO moderator Nate Williams, and Marigwen Kawakami. Is that right? Thank you very much to all of you for your hard work. This is just a reminder, please turn off your cell phones. Those joining us via Teams, please mute yourselves and turn off your video until it is your turn to speak so that we save our bandwidth. Today we'll have a hearing on SB 3002 sponsored by Senator Begich. Afterwards, we'll have a joint presentation from the Department of Revenue and the Department of Natural Resources. This bill touches on a few different tax policies. From our perspective as Senate Resources Committee, my plan is to focus on resources and save some of the other issues for a later date should it move to another committee. We'll also be hearing from our consultants, our LB&A consultants in the future, as soon as they prepare what we've asked them to accomplish in terms of some research. After we've heard from them, we'll schedule another hearing for public testimony. Again, we're working inside a really short time frame, but we'll try to provide as much notice to members of the committee and the public as possible every step along the way. So let's get started. I'd like to invite Senator Begich, the Senate Minority Leader, to please come forward, sir, place yourself on the record, and provide your opening comments, and I believe you have a presentation.
For the record, Senator Tom Begich, District J, and I'd like to invite my Chief of Staff and Legislative Assistant, Mercedes Colbert, to join us, if that's all right with you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you. Please do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to start with a brief sponsor statement and some comments and then turn it over to Ms. Colbert for the sectional analysis and then a brief presentation before you shift to your other presentations from the Department of Revenue and others. But I want to give some context to this legislation. And again, I want to thank you and the committee for hearing Senate Bill 3002. This bill is an act establishing an income tax on certain entities in the state relating to the motor fuels tax and relating to non-transferable tax credits against the oil and gas production tax and providing for an effective date. As you are aware, the fiscal plan working group, at least two of whose members serve on your committee here, actively worked to develop the elements of a plan in a bipartisan manner. It was a historic occasion. It brought equal members of legislators from all four caucuses together. The brief plan that they came up with and some of their consensus statements were met with widespread support throughout the legislative body and beyond within the public and even the administration. We've all had some complimentary comments to make for the work that was done by the working group. As one of the elements of that working group plan was to not just look at how we're going to look at a percent of market value or constitutional amendments that might be addressed to those, how we approach the dividend, but also looking at revenue as one of the components of that plan. There are a number of different revenue pieces of revenue that have been proposed from time to time. I've proposed a number of revenue bills. Other members of this body have, and members in the other body have as well. What this particular bill does is address a portion of that goal by increasing the revenue from three existing sources, all based on proposed bills that have already been discussed and introduced during the 32nd legislature. And I think it's important to note that, Mr. Chairman, that these are elements of bills that have either, in some cases, even passed the Senate in prior legislatures, but have been discussed since 2016. These are not new proposals. In fact, there's nothing novel or new about any of these three proposals that are incorporated in one bill. They are consistent with past discussions that this body and the other body have had extensive hours and hours of hearings, and they were chosen precisely for that reason, because they would make your process that much easier in terms of moving this to its next committee of referral. And I'm going to stress that in just a moment. The initial revenue estimates are based on the fiscal plan working group's assumptions. And I want to really underscore that. Two members of the House minority, two members of the Senate minority, two members of the House majority, two members of the Senate majority agreed on assumptions that would underscore any fiscal bills that they would address or look at. Those assumptions underlie everything that we did in this to provide integrity to that process. So those assumptions were presented last month, and if this bill were to pass this fiscal year, based on those assumptions, it would increase revenue by approximately $195 million. Of that, $110 million approximately comes from the change to the per barrel tax credit structure. Another $18 million or so comes from the motor fuels tax adjustment, and then expanding the corporate income tax to ensure that certain corporate entities would pay the same type of corporate income tax that our other corporations pay. That would produce another $67 million. And so that's what this bill is designed to do. What this comes down to for me is the need to see, whether it's from a minority member or a majority member, the need for a revenue bill to move to the Finance Committee. Now, on your committee, two of your members, Mr. Chairman, are members of the Finance Committee, and I know that they will pay attention not just during this hearing, but when this bill moves to them, hopefully very quickly, they'll be able to dig in deeper to the financial aspects of this bill. Now, in hearing this bill, you're going to hear objections to the bill, mainly from the industry, and I'm going to talk about that briefly in presupposition of those objections that you will likely hear. We're going to hear about lack of competitiveness. We're going to hear about some sense that this will be painful. This $110 million in additional taxation will be painful to the industry. And I want to just say, Mr. Chairman, before that discussion begins, for the last 5 years in this body, I have voted and supported legislation that would reduce the dividend check because it was for the right interests of the constituencies that I serve in the broad run. To the tune of $8.4 billion of not paid dividends that have gone, then not gone to members of the Alaska public. So I find it ironic that you will likely hear objection to a bill that would tax $110 million while we have asked Alaskan citizens to put up the equivalent of $2 billion or more a year in their own expected income. So with that, Mr. Chairman, and those opening comments, I'd like to turn this over to my chief of staff to go through a quick sectional analysis. Sure.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Begich, I got the $110 million tax credits, $18 million motor fuels. What was the corporation, the S corporation?
$67
million. 67?
In the first year, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Other questions? Please, Senator Begich, continue.
I'd like to turn over now to Senator Begich, for the record, I'd like to turn it over now to Mercedes Colbert, my chief of staff, to walk through the sectional.
Yes, Mercedes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mercedes Colbert, staff to Senator Tom Begich of Anchorage. And this is a sectional analysis for Senate Bill 3002, version B as in boy, that's before you. Section 1, this section of the bill will add a new section to the Alaska Net Income Tax Act. This section establishes a new tax of 9.4% for certain corporations that earn at least a $4 million on qualified net taxable income. This applies to sole proprietorships, partnerships, or federally defined S corporations and C corporations, which are not publicly traded.
And if I may interrupt, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Senator Begich, for the record, I want to clarify what that means. So if you're a company that has a net income of $4.1 million, your tax, the 9.4% tax, is on $100,000, the amount above $4 million in net taxes. So it's very important for you to understand it's not 9.4% of $4.1 million, it's 9.4% of the net income above $4 million. Does that make sense, Mr. Chairman?
I think so, Senator Begich. And where did you come up with the $4 million threshold?
As, again, Senator Begich, for the record, as mentioned before, this is based on existing legislative bills that have been proposed. So this is actually based on existing legislation that has been introduced by Senator Wilikowski for 3 years running, and that number was an arbitrary cutoff mark. I think Ms. Colbert may have something more to add to that.
Yes, through the chair, Mercedes Colbert. The $4 million threshold and a lot of the legislation that's been introduced in the legislature in recent years, it tended to be, those iterations of the bills tended to be more focused specifically on oil and gas companies. In more recent years, that was specifically more targeted to a particular company that bought out recent shares of another particular company. So that was more targeted at that specific entity. That's one part of that. But I believe revenue may be able to speak a little bit more to that as well.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Von Inhoff, do you have any questions?
Thank you. I do have just have one question. It just seems that it's a cliff. We go from zero to, what is it, 9.4%? Is that what it is?
Senator Begich?
Through the chair, Senator Von Inhoff, yes, it goes to 9.4%, mirroring the high tax that we currently have for the corporate income tax, which stair steps up to 9.4% for companies earning over $220,000 in net profits, $220,000. So what this does is it doesn't lower the threshold for S-Corps down to that $220,000. In fact, it sets a much, much higher ceiling at $4 million. And what it essentially says is that these are corporations that, for one reason or another, have chosen not to have chosen to organize in such a way as they don't pay a corporate income tax, which is paid by every other corporation in Alaska that does, in fact, fall under our corporate income tax law. They pay a federal income tax and they pay a corporate state income tax. These corporations pay a federal income tax, but they do not pay a state income tax. And we're actually setting the threshold quite high at $4 million, as opposed to setting the threshold where we conceivably could have set it at $220,000. And the reason I didn't want to set the threshold lower than this, not just because of the prior bills, but because that affects a lot of mom-and-pop businesses, and I didn't want those to be impacted by this. The reference that Ms. Colbert made, Mr. Chairman and Senator Von Imhoff, to a particular company is we had a company, British Petroleum, that paid corporate income tax in this state. When they sold their assets, they took at least $40 million off the table that was being paid into state coffers. So we ended up with a net deficit when they sold, when they diversified and they divested themselves of their assets in this state, they also divested this state of $40 million in taxable income. And in doing so, it follows a pattern of the industry in this state of divesting itself of its resources here, investing that resource that they are gaining and the profit they are gaining here in different kinds of investments around the world and leaving us holding the bag. And so this was a way of recapturing some of that lost income that the state had previously received from these exact same assets. But it goes beyond that in incorporating any business that makes nets, not grosses, but nets over $4 million. But it doesn't start the taxing button until after you've reached $4 million, and then it only taxes the income above $4 million, and it's net income.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can I follow up, please?
Very fundamental thing here that no expert on taxation, but can you help me understand? I keep hearing that S corporations don't pay a corporate income tax, but they do individually, the owners pay an income tax. Now,
that's correct.
Can you tell me what that amount is that the owners are paying to the state of Alaska?
Well, through the chair, Senator Begich, for the record, through the chair, Senator Stevens, the owners do not pay an income tax in the state of Alaska. They pay no income tax in the state of Alaska. So when you hear the argument that this is double taxation, it is the double taxation that any corporate income tax payer is also under in the state of Alaska. They pay a state corporate income tax, and they pay a federal income tax. An individual in the state of Alaska does not pay an income tax. However, if those individuals would like to pay an income tax, I have a bill that does that as well. I would be more than happy to have that entertained. But this bill would simply say that those individuals who are paying a federal income tax would also end up paying a state corporate income tax like every other corporation in the state of Alaska does.
So, Mr. Chairman, that's a true loss of $40 million to the state of Alaska, moving from a one corporation to the S Corp, right?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. That is correct, Mr. Senator Stevens. And I think Senator Von Imhoff had a follow-up.
Yes, Senator Von Imhoff. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, Senator Von Imhoff. Go ahead.
Thank you. I understand that I'm at a disadvantage being here, and I do appreciate you accommodating me, and I will be in Juneau here shortly. The issue is that based on Senator Begich's comments, I do see highlighting the particular company that has recently left. I just can't help but think that this is a specifically targeted tax on a particular company. I just feel that way based on the comments. But one of the things that I have in subsection C, I'm looking at the bill here, it says the aggregate of qualified taxable income. What does qualified taxable income mean? I've never heard that as an IRS-defined code. Thank you.
I'm going to let, through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I'm going to let Emily Nauman answer that question specifically. But before I do, I just want to comment that what the example that I've given did was it highlighted a flaw in our system that I was not fully aware of. They are one entity. We were very particular when discussing this bill and this draft with legislative legal that we were not trying to single out a single company. We were trying to find a threshold that would not destroy mom-and-pop businesses but would apply to other businesses that, in fact, netted $4 million or higher. And, in fact, you probably have received some correspondence from other businesses that this would affect. It's not to single out a single business. It is just that that single business has underscored that at least $40 million in revenue was lost to the state of Alaska because of this loophole. And so the goal is to fill the loophole, not to target a company, but to fill the loophole. Now, good corporate businesses should be more than happy to pay their fair share as being part of this state's corporate infrastructure, and I'm hoping that they will see that the same way. And with that, I'd like to ask.
Well, actually, here's what I'd like to do, Senators Von Imhoff and Senator Begich. If DOR could please hold these questions, I'm sure we'll have a lot of other questions, but just for the sake of keeping this moving in the right direction, I'd like to continue with our presentation. And as we have questions for DOR, please note those, and we'll get to the Department of Revenues later. I have a question. These are S-Corps and LLCs and every entity, right, making over $4 million partnerships, small
correct
businesses?
Correct. Sole proprietorships. That's
okay. Right. Okay. I just wanted to make sure. Do we have any other questions?
I think we're on Section 2, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Okay, for the record, Mercedes Colbert. Moving on to Section 2 in the sectional analysis. Section 2 of the bill increases the surcharge from 0.0095 cents per gallon to double that amount to 0.015 cents per gallon on refined fuel sold, transferred, or used in Alaska. Section 3 of the bill increases the tax on motor fuel sold or transferred within the state from 8 cents to 16 cents per gallon. This section also increases the motor fuel sold and transferred for the use in and on watercraft from 5 cents to 10 cents per gallon. Section 4 increases the tax on motor fuel consumed from 8 cents to 16 cents per gallon as well. This section also increases the tax on motor fuel consumed for the use in and on watercraft from 5 cents to 10 cents per gallon. Section 5 of the bill amends Alaska Statute 43.40.030A relating to the refund of the motor fuel tax for non-highway use by increasing the fuel tax refund from 6 cents to 12 cents per gallon for internal combustion engines. This adds a 5 cent per gallon refund eligibility for commercial fishing watercraft.
We have a question from Senator Michicki.
Yeah, thank you. A trend around the country with a growing proportion of electric vehicles is, so as you know, a lot of these tax dollars go to highway maintenance. Electric vehicles also enjoy the benefits of highway maintenance. A lot of the tax bills we're seeing around the country includes a fee to try to bring in a similar amount of tax dollars for an electric vehicle as well. Some also have a blend for hybrids at a lower rate. Is there was that something you considered in this bill? And if not, why didn't you?
Senator Machiki through the chair, President Machiki through the chair. We did consider it. It was in the original motor fuels bill. And the reason it isn't in here is on recommendation of Ledge Legal Counsel. And I think, again, Emily Nauman could speak to that from Ledge Legal. But it created, because we're dealing with three different tax segments here, it was dealing with fees, and it might have led to a single subject rule violation. And that is the only reason it's not included. If Emily were to comment on that, and, you know, certainly we would be willing to go back to the original language, but I wouldn't want to risk the integrity of the bill to do so. Certainly I would support such legislation, standalone legislation, be happy to introduce it, or if one of you were to introduce it, I'd be happy to support it. But what I wouldn't want to do is violate, the only reason it was taken out was because of on advice of legislative legal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and we will. Forgive me, I said Department of Revenue, but we will hear from legislative legal. So we'll rehash these in just a bit. Why the exemption for did you say the fishing vessels, was it? Or
commercial fishing vessels.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and how much would that be, do we know?
Mr. Chairman, I think you're asking the question to Senator Begich for the record. I think you're asking the question of what would the total be?
Right, correct.
I am not exactly sure. I think we'd have to get our Ledge Finance people to tell us that answer to that question. I can tell you that this was part of the legislation, which is why we left it in there. And I know it was introduced on the House side by the member from Kodiak, and I didn't really feel it would be in our best interest to remove a section from the member from Kodiak, given that the senator from Kodiak is on your committee. So I just left it in as it was in its final version when it passed the Senate and moved through the committee process in the House. But we'll get that number. I think we can have, I think Connor's on the line and we'll make a note of that and ask him to at some point provide that information to you if that's.
Great, thank you. Please continue. Are we on slides? Are you moving through your slides?
Okay. No, we're just finishing the sectional. The slides will go very quickly. They're very similar to the sectional.
For the record, Mercedes Colbert, moving on to Section 6 of your sectional analysis before you. Section 6 amends Alaska Statute 43.55.024J. This is relating to the non-transferable oil production tax credits. This section repeals the $8, $7, and $6 per barrel tax credits, effectively capping the per barrel tax credit at $5 per barrel if the average gross value at the point of production for the month is less than $110 per barrel. Section 7 of the bill applies the new corporate income tax established in Section 1 of this bill to the tax year beginning on or after January 1, 2022. Section 8 of the bill is transition language for the Department of Revenue to adopt the regulations necessary to implement this bill if it is passed into law. Regulations may not take effect before January 1, 2022. Section 9 is the immediate effective date to allow the Department of Revenue to begin work on those regulations authorized in Section 8. And finally, Section 10, except for Section 9 just described, this bill takes effect January 1, 2022.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Begich, for the record, Mercedes will now go through a PowerPoint presentation. And I would just add that it's our hope that in the Finance Committee, this bill and legislation relating to the dividend might become contingent on each other, and that would be my hope, so that if indeed we didn't make a change to the dividend statute, this bill would not take effect, or that if indeed this bill were to take effect, it would only take effect if indeed there was a change to that statute. So I'm hoping that will happen in the Finance Committee.
And you mentioned that earlier, Senator Begich, you mentioned the dividend before. The purpose behind this is for a bigger dividend?
The purpose of this bill is to ensure that we have an overall fiscal plan. The fiscal plan working group identified that a fiscal plan must include things like a constitutional percent of market value, a finality to the dividend question, revenue to help ensure that we have a balanced budget, and a review of some budget cutting. What I've chosen to do is put forward one of those elements or two of those elements. Others have put forward some of the other elements. If we are serious about a fiscal plan, Mr. Chairman, we have to consider all of these. It pains me to have to vote for things I don't care for, but I will do so because, as the President has said often in not just in committee, but in public statements, and I would just want to align myself with those statements. We have to be all in if we're going to get this fiscal ship set aright. So this is one component of that. The intent is not to pay a higher dividend or a lower dividend. The intent is to have a comprehensive fiscal plan, which will include elements that those who support a higher dividend don't like and those who support a lower dividend don't like. So it's going to be a plan that none of us like.
I believe we have a question from Senator Bishop.
No, I'm good.
No? Do we have questions? Senator Michicki?
So in Section 2, thank you, Mr. Chairman, the increase in the surcharge from 0.95 cents to gallon per gallon to 1.5, was that calculated to capture the gap in the SPAR funding, and do we know if the department is in support with that?
Through the chair to Senator Michicki, it does meet the capture amount that was discussed in the subcommittee on the Department of Environmental Conservation that Senator Wilson, myself, and Senator Rivak sat on. It is the amount that we discussed at that time. I don't know the position of the department on it, but I believe they were supportive of an increase. I know that it was discussed at the very least in that committee, and both Senator Wilson and myself supported that increase. I can't remember if you did, Senator Rivak, but the idea was to make that fund whole because that fund was decreasing rapidly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question on Section 6 of the bill, the per barrel credits. It's a different approach than I think I saw another proposal may have come from the administration. This deletes the credits at the lower net oil prices, but keeps the credits at the higher net oil prices. And I guess that's a little bit counterintuitive to me, rather than shifting the brackets down and adjusting our taxes when the net on oil is low. This seems to keep them when the net is a little bit higher. Can you give me the thinking on that, or would you be amenable to shifting more toward the other approach?
Senator Begich, for the record, through the chair. Senator Keel, I'm always amenable to another approach. This approach seemed to be less damaging to the oil industry and more favorable to the state's position, in so much as it might garner less opposition from the oil industry. I've since learned that that is not true. So the I guess, you know, it was an attempt to compromise before I needed to. So I'm very much open to any changes that this committee or the Finance Committee might choose to make to that structure. It doesn't go as far as Senator Wilkowski's bill, which would have eliminated the tax credits entirely. My preferred approach would be a property tax, and I propose such a property tax, but it's in a different committee where it has not moved. That property tax would have netted more money, but been predictable for the industry, and it appeared to be something that the industry was interested in when I first proposed and discussed it with the industry. But the industry came out against that bill too, as they seem to do on every effort to get the industry to pay more. So my hope is that we can find some place where the pain is just a little less, and all of us are willing to do it. But if you have a better proposal, I have no objection to anything you would choose to do to this bill to make it better.
Question?
Yes. Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So Senator Begich, you mentioned this bill is less damaging to the oil industry. So how did you evaluate that? How did you define less damaging other than just comparing it to Senator Wilkowski's bill?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that is the comparison I used. If we adopted the Wilkowski support, which I also support, you would zero out the tax credits. And I think that on the face of it, that would appear to be more damaging to the oil industry than providing some tax credits would. So this bill this bill is a compromise before a compromise perhaps was necessary. But my goal was to kick us off I center and move us forward with revenue. And I'm hopeful that we can do that. But any bill that adds a tax burden to any industry is obviously going to be less favorable to them than no bill that does that. Likewise, any reduction of a dividend check is more damaging to an individual than no reduction of a dividend check in the real terms of an actual reception. So I would just say that this approach was designed to, in the spirit of compromise expressed by the working group, to move us off the revenue high center to get us talking about revenue. If we're going to talk about an overall fiscal plan, you must have a revenue element or there is no fiscal plan. If we are serious about doing an overall plan that includes a percent of market value, a new dividend formula, some sort of cuts, a spending cap, then it also has to have revenue. And if it doesn't have revenue, it is not a fiscal plan. And that is what this bill is designed to do, is to get us into that discussion of revenue. And that's why I'm hopeful that after the Resources Committee has spent 2 days on it, that they will at least move it forward to where you, Senator Von Imhoff, you, Senator Bishop, and other members of the Finance Committee can take the work from this committee and further massage it, given the fiscal analysis ability that exists on the Finance Committee as well.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Yes, thank you. So other than the evaluation, comparing it to Senator Wilikowski's, what I'm hearing is that there has not been an overall economic evaluation of how this particular bill could potentially affect the investment in the North Slope, which, of course, is the highest employer in the state of Alaska with very competitive jobs. It's just something that I think is missing in the discussion. The other thing is, you know, just to address the comprehensive fiscal plan, I think what happens is any revenue measures that we look at, doesn't even matter really what they are. The question is what are we going to spend those new dollars? Whether we cut the budget and yield new cash flow that way, or the price of oil goes up, or we have revenue measures of any kind, what are we going to utilize that money for? And if it's just to pay a big dividend and to leave other things by the wayside, bridges, airports, infrastructure, you name it, I think that's where the rub begins. And so I do appreciate the conversation, Senator Bagage, but I think that until the permanent fund dividend is solved, new revenue is just going to turn right around and I fear not be spent to the many needs that the state of Alaska has. So thank you, Senator Rivak, for allowing me to comment. Thank you.
Senator Rivak, through the chair.
Yes, Senator Bagage.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that's why there will be contingency language or this bill won't pass. This would be contingent on a change to the dividend statute or you wouldn't be able to pass it. The idea is, in fact, to take into account all of these measures together. If we aren't going to take into account seriously revenue, and if we are going to end up delaying once again the discussion of revenue from the industry's perspective, then I think we are making a serious mistake in efforts to reach an overall plan. The industry is critically important to the state of Alaska. There is no doubt about that. The largest employer in the state of Alaska, though, is the fishing industry, followed by the state of Alaska itself is the second largest employer in the state of Alaska. And then after that, local government. And the largest private employer, single private employer, may well be, in terms of salaries earned, the industry. But those are also uncaptured dollars because a good portion of the industry's employees don't live in the state of Alaska. And if we even passed an income tax, it wouldn't be covered by it necessarily. They ought to be covered by it. But what I'm trying to do here is do a balance of resources and a balance of interests. It includes individuals in the state of Alaska. It includes the industry. It includes motor fuels. Every one of us pays something under this as well. And it's designed to be part of a fiscal plan triggered with everything from a percent of market value to a dividend. So it is all-inclusive in this conversation. And it's hard for me to have this conversation not looking you in the eye because you're behind me. But it feels awkward because we've discussed these very issues. I want to move Alaska forward, and this is one way we can do it. And, again, I leave it to the committees to change this bill any way they want. But we must have revenue as part of this discussion, or there will be no definitive answer. We know that from all the debate that's gone on with the dividend. There will be no definitive answer to the dividend question. We will never resolve anything if we don't do all of these things at the same time. We know that because that is the loggerhead we have run into time and time again. So I am asking, in fact, I'm imploring this committee and the rest of the legislature, the House and the Senate, to consider revenue alongside a dividend change, not one before the other, or you will never get it. And that's why this bill was put forward, in an effort to get us off the high-centered mark we're on. I respect that we want to defend ourselves and not necessarily do revenue. I don't really want to do revenue, but we have to do revenue as part of a broader fiscal plan. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the diligence.
Thank you, Senator Begich. You mentioned the fishing industry and how big they are and how many people they employ, and again, that they were exempted from this bill. And I'm curious, have you thought about other folks or other industries related to the motor fuel tax, or even, you know, partnerships or smaller LLCs? I mean, it's, you know, really $4 million in revenue for an LLC isn't really that big. And so we'll dig into that a little bit later. But, you know, I imagine that there's small businesses that would have something to say about that. Have you thought about, or is that the only industry that you've exempted?
No. Through the chair, Senator Begich, for the record, to the chair. Number one, the threshold of $4 million can be adjusted, of course, either up or down. Constituents in my own district have made sure to make me well aware that they do not want it to affect smaller businesses. They don't want to impact smaller businesses because it could make a difference to a smaller business. It's a net income of $4 million, not a gross income, and that's important to emphasize. And again, the tax isn't on the $4 million. It's on the amount above the $4 million. But I've been approached by chamber members who've requested that number be lifted. I have no objection to a lifting of that number to a higher threshold, should that be necessary, number one. Number two, the motor fuels tax and the exemptions in the motor fuels tax are based on the bill that passed the Senate. I took the bill that passed the Senate last year and was nearly ready to pass had we not had COVID, likely would have passed the other body, the House, as well. And I just took it effectively word for word from its final version, with the intent on trying to get something that we had already reached consensus in the Senate on to make it easier to move the bill through the process. So that's the motor fuels tax. That was based on the compromises made by the body themselves. And Senator Bishop was the author of that bill and perhaps could speak to it and more eloquently than I have. And then finally, on all of these plans, I've tried to start from the place we've left them the last time we discussed them, with hopes that since we had reached some broader consensus at those points, even in discussion of the per barrel tax credits, discussions I've had with members of the Finance Committee last year, which did look at a $5 amount, you know, this was reflective of those. So these are not new conversations. These are conversations that we've had. So I'm trying to start from the compromises we've already reached and build from there. But I don't know, Senator Rivek, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if Senator Bishop might have a better answer to the motor fuels tax change, since I took it directly from his bill. This is the plagiarist's bill. This is Wilikowski's bill. This is Bishop's bill. This is other people's bills that are incorporated here.
Well, thank you, Senator Begich. And I just wanted to see if we had thought that through in this big, I don't know if we call it an omnibus tax bill or what we call it, but if you'd like to speak to that, I was just curious if we had thought that through. But we do have a question from Senator Stevens.
Thank you. It was answered. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Von Imhoff? Okay. Please, Senator Begich, continue, or Mercedes, or...
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Mercedes Colbert for the record. That is a perfect segue to the beginning of the slideshow. And I'll go through them quickly. Of course, I'm not actually, of course, going to speak to the individual bills that are listed here, but I just want to make this as a point that many of these concepts before you have been discussed on the record, sometimes introduced and not discussed on the record, but they have been out there over the better part of the last 4, sometimes 5 or 6 years. So starting with the legislative history of corporate income taxes, sometimes they applied to S-corps only, sometimes C-corps, sometimes both. Sometimes only oil and gas companies, but nonetheless, since 2017, we've seen at least 5 different bills introduced regarding the what is known as the loophole for S corporations and or C corporations tax income taxes. And as you can see in this list, there have been a number of hearings that had been held, mostly in the further past, but the more recent bills, particularly this legislature and the past, they did not receive hearings. And the next slide, recent legislative history for motor fuels taxes is a little more, there's quite a bit more history on that, and thankfully in large part to one of our members here in the committee. In this current legislature, there is a bill sitting in House Finance now. It had already been moved out of the House Transportation Committee and is largely reflected in this bill as well. And that has been heard in House Finance this year and is still in that committee. And, of course, last legislature we had Senate Bill 115 that made it very close to the finishing line. And as Senator Begich mentioned, it became a casualty of the very shorted session with the pandemic ahead of us. In the 30th legislature, we had House Bill 60 and the companion bill, Senate Bill 25. If I recall, that might have been the previous administration's bills. And those were heard. Those were considered. They did not make it all the way to the floor. They were introduced in the first special session and were not heard at all. In the 29th legislature, in 15-16, there were a number of bills that were introduced by legislators and the former governor. And what was affectionately known as the taxi bus of the fourth special session, that was a large omnibus bill that was put forward in the fourth special session that year. And each of those were a number of taxes on a number of industries, including the mining industry, the fishing industry, the motor fuels taxes. I think there was a sales tax plus an income tax. It was every tax you can think of just to put some things on the table. So the purpose of lining these out is to show we have been talking about a number of taxes on the record, and a number of them have taken the different shapes. And of course, legislators have changed ever since, and it's important to keep moving this conversation forward. And finally, the legislative history of per barrel oil tax production credits is just as rich as our oil fields themselves, I believe. In the 32nd legislature of this current year, there was a bill that was introduced, so far has not heard any hearings in the regular session. Just this morning, the House Ways and Means Committee had its first hearing on its bill on that was somewhat similar to this but different, as Senator Keel pointed out, that made different changes to the price points and the per barrel caps for those tax credits. In the thank you. In the 31st legislature, there was a similar bill, Senate Bill 129, received no hearings that legislature. In the 30th legislature, in 17 and 18, we saw we actually did see some movement on per barrel tax credits. That included repealing the net operating loss credits, and there were some considerations of changing the per barrel taxes that we're talking about now, but that did not become law. And the House Finance Committee of that legislature did discuss further changes to per barrel tax credits under House Bill 411, and it was not able to get out of that committee. And then finally, in the 29th legislature, going back to 15 and 16, again, changes to the per barrel tax credits were considered in House Bill 247. That did become law, but they were not made. And in House Bill 326, there were no hearings on that bill, and they were referred to referrals as well. And these are not comprehensive. There are a number of others. There are a lot of other bills that were introduced that were similar. And then just briefly, I'm going to walk through what the bill does a little more detail. I think we covered the income tax, the corporate income tax a little bit. Again, Senate Bill 3002 would apply a 9.4% net income tax to sole proprietorships, partnerships, S corporations, and C corporations that make at least $4 million in profits. This language was used in bills that were introduced in the recent past, and that's where this language was lifted from. As Senator Begich says, it's the plagiarist bill. And likewise, just a really brief history on motor fuels taxes. We haven't, the state of Alaska hasn't changed motor fuel taxes since 1970. That's an 8-cent tax on motor fuel that would be worth 54 cents today. It is still, it's still at 8 cents. The average cost of a gallon of gas in the United States was 36 per gallon. That means the average cost of maintaining a roads, the cost of having gasoline in the air and maintaining the roads, everything that you can imagine, that was 36 cents per gallon in 1970. But today it is now $2.94. So Alaska's fuel tax has actually lost 85% of its purchasing power that would help pay for highway, ferry, and harbor maintenance. And this is just a very brief history of how our motor fuels taxes have moved through time. The Alaska has levied its first motor fuel tax in 1945 at 1 cent. And of course, in 1970, we established the current rate at 8 cents. 1977, the marine fuel tax was increased by 5 cents. 94, the aviation fuel tax, which by the way, this bill does not change. The 94 tax had increased to 0.047 cents per gallon on aviation fuel only. And then finally, in 2015, we saw the surcharge for the SPAR fund, the Spill Prevention and Response Fund for the Department of Environmental Conservation. And currently, Alaska is at the 50th. It ranks 50th in the nation in motor fuel taxes. We could also rank 50th for marine fuel taxes. If this bill passes that is drafted, those particular sections of the bill, we would then rank at 43rd in the nation and stay competitive at 50th in the nation for marine fuel. And because we don't actually change the aviation fuel in this jet fuels, and this is largely because of the efforts in the past that where motor fuels were introduced in recent legislatures, and there was a big outcry on increasing the jet fuel tax. So as we know, Anchorage was the fourth or fifth busiest cargo airport in the nation. So that was a huge part of that, was to keep Alaska competitive. So that was not considered in this bill. And the rough estimates for revenue for motor fuel taxes, I believe we didn't get the fiscal note quite yet, last I saw, just before coming down. But what we got from Ledge Finance, the highway fuel would estimate to be about $29 to $31 million a year. That's highway fuel. That goes to the highway fuel tax account, and that is largely used for maintenance of roads and is often used for the federal highway matching dollars. The marine fuel would go to the watercraft fuel tax account that is used for water and harbor facilities maintenance. That would be about $5.5 million a year. The refined fuel surcharge, that goes to the spill prevention and response fund for the Department of Environmental Conservation. That's about $3.5 million a year. And the total annual increase would be approximately upwards of $40 million a year, as drafted.
No, for the record, just Senator Begich, for the record, Mr. Chairman, that would mean that the total annual increase would go from $38.5 million to $40.7 million a year, correct? I just want to be sure.
I believe so. Yeah. Yes. And then just briefly on per barrel tax production, credits. Alaska Statute 43.55024J, which has been discussed at length over the last decade, really, in Alaska legislatures, that establishes non-transferable oil production tax credits, passed, of course, in SB 21 of 2013. This bill simply repeals the very top part, $8, $7, $6, and keeps the cap at $5 as written. This was a starting point for discussion, and we are very grateful for this good discussion today. And as written at that point, it would estimate to be the starting point of FY22 at $110 million a year, upwards to $440 million a year. And of course, this is a proposal and is up for amendments at any point, of course. And then in total, putting together the taxi bus, if you will, we have the estimates from Ledge Finance at this point, using the extrapolations from fiscal notes of recent years, of using the assumptions and baselines that the Fiscal Policy Working Group put together this summer. In FY22, these together are estimated to bring up to $195 million a year for that year, and then moving upwards steadily past $500 million a year by about FY30. And that's all for now.
Senator Begich, for the record, Mr. Chairman, that's our presentation, and we are open for questions. I know that you have other presentations scheduled, but we are open for questions if you have any additional ones.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Let's start before we get into, or do we have immediate questions for the bill sponsor?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Thank you. I just would be curious to know what happened to the revenue after the passage of 2013, in 2013 of Senate Bill 21, the lost revenue over those years. Can we see something that would tell us that?
For the record, Mercedes Colbert, I believe Department of Revenue plans to address that in their presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, and before we move on, I'd like to hear from Emily from Ledge Legal, the two questions that were asked previously. Emily, did you get those, and are you with us? Could you please put yourself on the record?
Yes, I did hear the questions. For the record, this is Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal. Related to the question about the aggregate qualified income, it's my understanding that that section is designed to avoid gaming of Section A, which puts a tax on entities with taxable income of $4 million, and the idea was that section was that an entity might artificially split itself into small units to avoid hitting the $4 million cap. And that section was designed to give the Department of Revenue the authority to combine the income of of entities that appeared to be doing that. Senator Michicki's question related to the electric vehicle fees. Mercedes accurately summarized the discussion that we had, that I did express a concern that a bill that touched both taxes and fees had the potential of having a single subject problem. I would place this at a low or moderate single subject risk. In general, fees are items collected that go back to, again, this is rough because of the dedicated funds provision of the last constitution, but that fees go back to the departments that they originate from, whereas taxes are collected more broadly and serve to fund the general fund. That said, I think in summary, it would be a low to moderate single subject risk, but I understand that the idea was to have a bulletproof bill because, of course, if a bill fails a single subject test, the entire bill fails.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Thank you, Senator Michicki, then Senator Keel.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Nauman. What's interesting is that Bill made it all the way through the Senate and a good part of the way through the House. So if you segmented out that portion of the bill, it still had apparently a low risk for a single subject challenge. And we, perhaps nobody asked you, but we, I don't remember hearing of there being an issue with a single subject with that other bill. Is there a reason, or did no one ask at the time? Is that which is a legitimate answer if that's the case?
For the record, again, this is Emily Nauman's Legislative Legal Services through the chair to Senator Michicki. That bill, the prior year's bill, all of those sections also related to motor vehicles. And this bill adds in, the bill in front of you adds in other provisions related to taxes. And so the single subject of the bill, in my opinion, has changed from motor vehicles to taxes.
Thank you.
Thanks. Before we move on to Senator Keel, I'd like to acknowledge that we have Representative Kronk in the room. Thank you for joining us, and Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In follow-up to Senator Michicki's line of questions, I guess I don't remember a distinction in our Constitution between taxes and fees. Certainly since the Division of Motor Vehicles raises 2.5, almost 3 times what it costs to run the Division of Motor Vehicles, there's a strong argument that all their fees really are taxes anyway. Have the courts opined on that difference here in Alaska as being something that's material or important that would come into a single subject decision?
The court, through the record, this is Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal, to Senator Keel through the chair. The courts have not opined on that specific distinction. I think it's been a lingering and sort of back and forth discussion between our attorneys and our office. And I had mentioned it as a possibility of a single subject violation, and it was my understanding to create a bill that just had zero risk in terms of the single subject rule. And I believe that's how it came out, but Mercedes could speak directly to her intent.
Well, through the chair, this Senator Begich, I will speak to the intent. The intent of it was to try to make sure we didn't get a bill struck down after we passed it, and we relied on the legal opinion of Legislative Legal to do that. But I certainly would not object to, as I said earlier, the surcharge language and the fee language that was listed for electric vehicles. My only caution would be if we pass a revenue bill and it gets struck down, it would invalidate the entire package if there is, in fact, contingent language. So you want to think about that and perhaps somebody here would propose a bill that would take that language and ensure that that language is addressed in a standalone piece of legislation, which I would certainly support.
Thank you.
No follow-up, Senator Keel? You look like you're itching to follow up.
Mr. Chairman, it strikes me as an exceedingly low likelihood that it would be struck down on single subject, and not to put too fine a point on it, I drive a battery car and I ought to pay. So when my teenager's behind the wheel, the guardrails are in great shape.
We all want you to pay, Senator. Do we have any other questions?
Yes, sir.
Yes, Senator Von Imhoff. Yeah, I'm sorry. Senator Bishop, then Senator Von Imhoff.
She can go.
Well, you ask. Go ahead, Senator Bishop.
I just want to, the genesis behind the motor fuel tax bill has not changed at all. And it would not have made it out of the Senate and all the way to the House floor if there hadn't been a need. I personally lost 5 maintenance stations in my district. Not blaming anybody, but, you know, we had to reduce revenue. Now, there's another senator here that can speak for himself in his district. But to be fair, there was a temporary reprieve, and thanks to the governor for doing that, but we used COVID relief money to open up several of those stations. That money's not forever. These problems are going to come back. That road to Prudhoe Bay, where used to be 90% of our revenue came from, still needs to be maintained. Those trucking companies were really, really in desperate need several years ago, to the point where they called me for meetings in the Interior delegation. That is not an easy road to drive, nor is a Sterling Highway in the dead of winter. And by God, if we can't take care of our roads, what can we take care of? So my position on supporting oil taxes has not changed. I mean, supporting motor fuel taxes.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So just kind of putting all this together, there does seem to be targeted taxes on some entities, but not on others. And the fairness aspect seems to be absent. And for example, for the motor fuels tax, there's a tax on everybody except for commercial fishing boats, which was brought up earlier. For the sub-S tax, but only on those entities above $4 million. And then the per barrel credit rollback, but only for Prudhoe Bay and nothing really for Cook Inlet. So it just seems like if we are going to be taxing and everyone's going to do their fair share and everyone's going to pitch in, then maybe we do a lower, broader tax on everybody versus just singling out various different industries, various different locations, various different sizes. So perhaps the sponsor of this bill could discuss on why he chose exemptions and what it might look like if there were no exemptions and everyone paid a low and broad tax. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Begich, please.
Senator Begich, for the record, to Senator Von Imhoff. Of course, I'd love to discuss that. That's why I introduced an income tax that would be broad-based, that would capture out-of-state income as well, and that would be based on your federal taxable income rate. And that was because I believe a broad-based tax is the only answer. Regretfully, the governor has signaled he will not support an income tax. No one has proposed a sales tax. There's no sales tax on the table right now from anybody. And so I chose 3 pieces of legislation, one of which had passed the Senate, the motor fuels tax, and 2 of which have had, at least according to members of the majority who've discussed them with me, enough support within the majority to potentially move to the floor and pass over to the House. These flawed bills, perhaps they are, which are bills that are written by other members of the legislature as well as myself combining them in this body, in this bill, are what looked like the consensus in its sloppiness that would be accepted by a majority, a simple majority in the legislature, in the Senate and the House, 11 and 21. If we can't move to any revenue by getting 11 votes and 21 votes in the two bodies, then the revenue discussion is moot, and we should not even be wasting our time here. I believe that we have to move forward with revenue, so I chose what appeared to be the easiest passage of revenue bills. But in a moment, Senator Von Imhoff, I am more than happy to have somebody consider my income tax bill and join me in co-sponsoring that income tax bill. It's a broad-based bill, and I'd be happy if others would join me in that. But I don't see the will for people to do that. In a moment, if an income tax bill or a sales tax bill was presented to this body that exempted the clothing and food essentials and didn't have a cap, I would be on board with that in a minute, because I think a broad-based tax is the fairest approach. However, it doesn't seem to have consensus in the legislature, so what I'm trying to do is find something where historically at least one element has found consensus on a bipartisan basis, and at least in the other two elements, a bipartisan group of senators have expressed to me support for those pieces. So that's where I'm coming from. I'm trying to be a realist, and I'm trying to get something through the process that will help us also drive the resolution of the dividend formula question and get us to a percent of market value as part of a comprehensive plan. So I want to reiterate that. These bills aren't designed to particularly single out one person or another. That they do that is a virtue or a result of how the legislative process has had these bills crafted and created as they've gone through the process. If you would like to change that, please do. Present the broad-based bill that I can support and that others can support. But we are running out of time. And so I am hopeful that this bill will have a fair hearing in this committee and that it will move to the next committee of referral so it can remain in consideration and be adjusted and changed in any way that the Finance Committee sits, which you sit on, would wish to change it, so that it can come before all of us in front of the Senate and hopefully reach where we can reach a consensus that will help move our state forward. I am open to any and all ideas that do that.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Senator Von Imhoff, follow-up.
Yes, thank you. You know, the Senator Begich has reminded this committee that a couple times that I do sit on Senate Finance, and that is true. And I would like to state for the record that as of now, our budget is balanced before paying a dividend, and we're only looking at new revenue in order to pay a dividend. While I'm not necessarily wholly opposed to that, I am opposed at all new revenue, any and all new revenue that we discuss, and whether it's a broad-based or a targeted, being paid towards a dividend. And right now, that's where it's looking. And I think that what Senator Bishop talked about earlier is this state has many needs. And until we solve the dividend crisis or the dividend calculation, we don't know where these taxes, where the revenue is going to go. So we're putting the cart in front of the horse right now. I know that people are talking about a comprehensive. I don't see it that way. I see it as a first comes the dividend, and then once we know what the dust is settled and where we land and we determine what our needs are, then we can begin to talk about taxes. So I think this bill is very premature. I think this bill is also very unfair and targeted and is targeting some industries above others. And I think it's going to have significant unintended economic, maybe it is intended economic consequences, who knows. But I'm not interested in really dissecting or even amending this bill too much, because I think that we have, we are not sure where this money is going to go. So thank you for the comment, Senator Rebeck.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. Senator Machicki.
Senator Rebeck, if I may.
Please, quickly, if you don't mind.
Senator Begich, for the record, the question of what my motivations are in intending this legislation, I just wanted to express to you my disappointment in hearing that comment from Senator Von Imhoff. My motivations are to solve the problems that were presented to us by the Fiscal Plan Working Group. To imply anything other than that is absolutely outrageous, and I am stunned that Senator Von Imhoff has done that. And I'm not even sure. I am so deeply offended by that I can't begin to tell you. And well, I just wanted to put that on the record, Senator Rebeck.
Thank you, Senator Begich, and I'll just remind members of the committee, I don't think folks are trying to impugn motives here. We certainly, this is obviously a very, very, can be a very emotional topic, and everybody has different opinions. So let's just please try and not impugn motives. Senator Machicki.
Well, I've been accused of being a peacemaker before, and I'll probably get accused of it again. I'm sensing a growing animosity for someone bringing an approach to the table that I don't think is becoming of legislators. Folks have a right to drop a bill. Folks have a right to have an idea. Our job as a committee or as any other legislator in any other committee or on the floor is to make it the very best bill we can, and if we're going to move it. But I agree that we just need to calm down a little bit. and talk about the bill. Let's talk about the bill. I have a couple questions about the bill. So I've talked about sort of an all-in plan, which sort of required low, broad, and as temporary as possible impacts to try to settle our fiscal plan, our fiscal situation. But back to this bill, Senate Bill 3002, I guess I have some questions about, we talked about the electric thing. So I would love to see the lobbyists from Tesla, the fishing industry, and the aircraft industry in here as well. I'm kind of wondering why we didn't, why we left some of those groups out in the approach on the fuel. So I'm just talking about the fuel tax section. And maybe you don't know. Maybe you don't know what led to that development, but it does seem my objectives in solving our fiscal gap were kind of more of an all-in, and I'm not saying that's not your approach. I don't think this is the be-all, end-all of what solves this problem. I don't think you intended that. You're starting a conversation, so I'm going to defend your start of that conversation. I don't think you have any motives other than that objective, but so if we were going to make some amendments to this bill, if this bill had any hope of moving beyond this committee, what left those other groups? So the reason I segmented out fuel tax, and we can talk about the other segments later, is the fuel tax part seems a little bit unfair, and the guys in my boatyard are going to give me hell, I can tell you that. But I don't know why there would be a 5 cents a gallon holiday for commercial fishermen, or why we maintain a whole bunch of airports in this state. I don't know why they wouldn't be included in that consideration as well. And if there's a competitive issue with international cargo transport, that's one thing. But can you touch on that a little bit?
Absolutely, Senator. Senator Machiki, Senator Begich for the record to the chair. Again, the bill was derived from the last version of the motor fuels tax. The reason the aviation fuel elements of the original versions of this bill that were proposed, I think, in 2017, I think was what Ms. Colbert's presentation indicated, were because of the clear and direct impact it would have on the competitiveness of the Fairbanks and the Anchorage airports in the world market. So those were withdrawn, and that was compelling testimony presented to the House Resources Committee at the time. As for the other elements, I've said again and again, and I'll say it again, these are starting points based on a piece of legislation that passed the Senate. It is effectively nearly the identical language to that bill. I don't know what compromises went on and what processes went on to get to that place, but when it came before the Senate, and I joined my colleagues in voting for the bill and helping pass that bill, proposed again by initially by Senator Bishop, that there were elements that we all believed should have been included in there and that weren't included in there. I would welcome any of them being included, with the caution that any time you add more to a bill, it makes it less likely that it will pass. But my goal is 21 and 11, and however you would like to adjust or change this bill to reflect perhaps more fairness in the process, I would welcome. But I would just remind the committee and the body that the body, for whatever reason, voted for this bill, including many of the members here in this committee, just recently in 2020, and did so in its present form. So fairness issues notwithstanding today, they certainly didn't prohibit a majority from voting for this bill in the past. However, that is not a roadblock for me. I didn't write that language. I am putting this language on the table so that we have a discussion that will move forward. Please change it in any manner that you feel comfortable so that it moves across the line.
Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Senator Machiki.
Thank you for that. That's fair, and it's a good statement. That's what we do. We change bills to make them better. A lot of mine have been changed, and some of the changes have made them better. The follow-up that I would have is you did bring up the competitiveness issue on the aviation fuel tax, and I think that is something that we do need to consider with all of the changes, and perhaps there are other parts of the economy that should contribute as well that aren't considered. So that's, I'm going to be looking at the competitiveness aspect. Perhaps there is a dang good reason why they're not included in this bill for aviation fuel. As a commercial fisherman, I use state services. I enjoy the benefits of the Harbor Fund. And I don't know why it would be excluded. There's somebody probably spray painting something on the side of my commercial boat right now, but I just think low, broad, and as temporary as possible is kind of the approach if we're going to get through this. Some of these won't be temporary, and a fuel tax likely won't be, but some of them could be. As we know, things improve over time in our fiscal situation, and we're trying to manage the next probably 3 to 5 years as the fund, permanent fund grows, and that's sort of what I'm looking at when I consider bills such as this. So I'll leave it at that, but thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Begich.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Senator Bishop.
I yield. Thanks.
No. Okay. I guess I have a quick question. I have a quick question. You mentioned that this was the $4 million net threshold on the corporate income tax was from a prior bill. Do you know if there was any if there were any studies or anything done to show what industries would be affected? Because I know there have been some small mining industries that have reached out, and some bigger mining folks that have said, "Hey, this will change our, this will change a lot for us." So I'm wondering, are you aware of any sort of studies that may have been done?
Senator Begich, for the record, Mr. Chairman, since none of those bills were ever granted a hearing, the ability to actually have that research done was limited. So had those bills been granted a hearing any time in the last 3 years, and those were Senator Wilikowski's bills, I think we would have had an answer to that question, a more comprehensive one. As of now, I am not aware of any. I don't know if Ms. Colbert is, or if our own legislative staff is perhaps aware of anything, if Connor is aware of anything. But Mercedes, are you aware of anything?
I am not.
Okay, so I'm not. And as I stated earlier, the $4 million is a presupposed number. Set a higher number. Set whatever number that the testimony identifies for you as the best number for that. Let it adjust the bill. And let's go with what the President has indicated, which is a broad, perhaps temporary, but fair approach to taxation. I'm more than happy to do that and have, as I said before and on the record, presented bills that do that. Again, those bills require hearings. All of us need to know what the process is going to be and whether or not these things are going to get consideration. And I appreciate you hearing this bill today, and I hope that we can, in the spirit of wanting to move revenue forward, that we can have a robust discussion that leads us to a place of compromise on this.
Well, thanks, Senator Begich, and that's exactly why we're here, hearing your bill. And again, to reiterate, from the perspective of this committee, we want to make sure that we know the effects on our industries and resources. I think that's our obligation and our duty as a resources committee to know what the effect is going to be of the policy. And so that's the reason that I asked the question. And you know, because if we don't know, then we can seek to find out. So I was just curious if you knew of anything. Are there any other questions before we move on to Department of? Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. a short comment and then a question on the bill. I guess with great respect to the member whose, I think, computer troubles may have disconnected, I don't think we have carts before horses or the other way around. I think we are nailing together a cart while we're stitching the harness, while we're teaching the horse to take a bit. And we're trying to do it all at once, and it's a little bit rough, but I appreciate that we're here. There's been a really good discussion about fairness within our resource industries, and a question to the sponsor about specifically the S-Corp piece of the bill, and in the oil patch. It seems to me that right now, because of the structure of our taxes, we have some large oil companies producing on the North Slope paying materially higher taxes to the state than others, or one other in particular, and they're producing the same resource out of the same basin under the same lease terms with the same basic cadre of employees and workforce structure. Is there a fairness issue without the bill that we need to solve?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes. And in fact, fairness goes both ways. And you have presented exactly a scenario for one company that would be affected by this bill, where in fact they do have an unfair competitive advantage over others in that same field, in that same resource area, you know, in terms of their competitive advantage because they don't have the income tax requirement. Consequently, that would be the same for any company earning $4 million in net profit or more that has chosen an S-corp to sort of or a C-corp provision to go around its corporate, otherwise corporate tax, income tax obligation. So yes, that is a fairness issue as well. Is it fair to, perhaps everyone should become an S-corp and perhaps everyone should avoid corporate income tax and then leave us a $200 million gap? Because that clearly is a possibility as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, thank you, Senator Begich and Mercedes, for presenting your bill. We appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the opportunity to present. I do have to go for my S-Corp now, and so I need to leave. But I actually have a meeting at 5 o'clock, so I'm going to leave. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, and we'll contact you in the event that we have further hearings and more to discuss. Again, I appreciate it. Next, we have a presentation from the Department of Natural Resources and jointly with the Department of Revenue. We're going to take a brief at ease while we set up that presentation. All right, we are back on the record. We are going to move on to our presentation, joint presentation between the Department of Natural Resources and Department of Revenue. I think the Department of Revenue is going to start us off. I'm not sure which one of you from the Department of Revenue, so if you could please go ahead and put yourself on the record. And Dirk Kraft here will move our slides. Is it you, Colleen?
Correct. So good afternoon, committee. For the record, my name is Colleen Glover, the Tax Division Director. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you an overview of Alaska's motor fuel tax, the corporate income tax, and the per barrel credits that are a component of the oil and gas production tax. Today, you will also hear from my colleagues, Nicole Reynolds, the Deputy Director, and Dan Stickle, the Chief Economist. This presentation is a fairly high level to look at the three tax programs that are included in Senate Bill 3002. And if there's additional questions that we don't have time to today or additional information after this presentation, we can certainly come back and do a more in-depth presentation if you would like.
Thank you.
So I'm going to pass the next section on the motor fuel on to Nicole Reynolds.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Nicole Reynolds. I'm the Deputy Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. We can move on to slide three. So slide three is an overview of the motor fuel tax statutes and the applicable regulations that interpret those statutes. Title 43, Chapter 40 are the Alaska statutes that contain the motor fuel tax provisions. And then I've also listed out the regulations here on this slide. Are there any questions on this slide?
No, please continue.
Okay, thank you. We can move on to slide four. So slide four contains the current motor fuel tax rates and the surcharge. So different rates apply to different types or uses of motor fuels, which I've shown here on this slide. According to the American Petroleum Institute, Alaska has the lowest combined federal, state, and local tax rate for both gasoline tax and diesel tax. Florida and Pennsylvania have lower excise fuel tax rates, but both of those states impose other taxes and fees on the fuel that bring their combined tax rates well above Alaska's combined rate. generally, motor fuel is taxed when it is sold by a qualified dealer. Those are wholesalers and distributors. And qualified dealers are responsible for collecting the tax and the surcharge and remitting those proceeds to the department monthly. Are there any questions on this slide?
Questions? No, please continue.
Okay. Slide five breaks out the total collections for each fuel type and the surcharge. Fiscal year 2017 through fiscal year 2020. These numbers were taken from our 2020 annual report, if you'd like to look at those further. the surcharge proceeds are considered unrestricted general fund revenue, and the money is set aside for appropriation to the Oil and Hazardous Substance Release Prevention Account. And that money is intended to benefit Department of Environmental Conservation Spill Prevention and Response Division. Tax proceeds are considered designated general fund revenue. Aviation fuel tax revenue, the first 60% of that revenue is refunded to local communities owning or operating an airport. And then the remaining revenue is deposited into the aviation fuel tax account in the general fund. The legislature may appropriate this money for capital and operating costs of airports. Revenue from the marine fuel tax is deposited into the watercraft fuel tax account in the general fund, and the legislature may appropriate this money for water and harbor facilities. Revenue from motor fuel tax on non-highway vehicles is deposited into the non-public highway use account in the general fund, and the legislature may appropriate this money to the Department of Transportation for trail staking and shelter construction and maintenance. And then all other revenue from all other motor fuel tax is deposited into the highway fuel tax account in the general fund, and the legislature may appropriate this money to Department of Transportation for maintenance of highways, construction of highway projects, and ferries. Are there any questions on this slide?
No, please continue.
Okay, thank you. So now I'll move on to the corporate income tax, and we can go to slide 7. So this slide here just lays out the various statutes that concern corporate income tax in Alaska. So we have AS 4319, which is the multi-state tax compact. I've also listed out the relevant regulations that interpret those statutes. AS 4320 is the Alaska Net Income Tax Act, and I've listed out the regulations that interpret those statutes. And then Alaska also adopts by reference various provisions of the Internal Revenue Code, and I've listed those out there by reference. One thing to note for the adoption of the Internal Revenue Code provisions is the language as amended. And this is important because this means that Alaska adopts any changes to the Internal Revenue Code as they happen. And this is called rolling conformity as opposed to static conformity. So these IRC provisions have full force and effect unless they are accepted to or modified by other provisions of AS 4320. and then there are some explicit exceptions and modifications in those statutes. So are there any questions on this slide?
No, please continue.
Okay, great. Moving on to slide 8. An entity's Alaska taxable status depends on how they filed federally because Alaska adopts those federal provisions that I listed on the previous slide. This means that only those entities that file as C corporations federally are taxable under Alaska's corporate income tax provisions. Certain C corporations are exempt from Alaska's corporate income tax, and those include certain qualified small businesses with less than $50 million in assets and that also meet certain industry requirements, and then also electric and telephone cooperatives that pay tax under AS 1025. There are many different types of business entities that are not subject to Alaska's corporate income tax provisions. Examples include S corporations, limited liability companies, partnerships, and sole proprietorships.
I have a question, Nicole, real quick. Do we know how many of those sole proprietorships, partnerships, LLCs, and S-corps exist in Alaska that might be affected, or just how many in general? Any of that information do we have?
In general, we did obtain some information from DCCED on the total number of these types of entities in Alaska, and it's well over 20,000, but in terms of how many of those corporations would be impacted by SB 3002, we did a very rough estimate based on the limited information we have, and we believe that bill would impact less than 900 of those entities in Alaska.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you. So I suppose you provided the expected revenue from this bill to Senator Begich for 3002?
We didn't provide those numbers to Senator Begich, but if there's questions on the fiscal note, our chief economist, Dan Stickle, is on the line, and he would be able to answer questions on those.
Okay, I can wait.
If we could. Dan, if you could make a note, and we'll get back to that. I don't want to get too far off of your presentation. Nicole, thank you for that. Do we have any other questions related to these other corporations or where we're at currently? members of the committee. No, thank you, Nicole. Please continue.
Thank you. So moving on to slide 9, this slide here contains our current corporate income tax rates. And a taxpayer's applicable rate is determined by the amount of their net taxable income. Senator Von Imhoff asked a question earlier about what the term qualified taxable income means in SB 3002. And since the entities subject to Section 1 of that bill are currently not taxable under state or federal law, this term would need to be further defined define what qualified taxable income means. So I just wanted to mention that. But moving on, so the maximum tax rate in Alaska is 9.4% for taxpayers with taxable income over $222,000. And the tax rates as they exist today were last modified in 1981. Are there any questions on this slide?
Questions? No, please continue.
Okay, thank you. So moving on to slide 10, this slide breaks out the total collections for oil and gas corporate income taxpayers and non-oil and gas corporate income tax payers for fiscal year 2017 through 2020. These numbers were also taken from our 2020 annual report, if you would like to look at that further. oil and gas corporate income tax collections resulting from assessments are deposited into the CVRF, and all remaining corporate income tax collections are deposited into the general fund. Are there any questions on this slide?
I have a question. How much is currently paid out in per barrel tax credits? Is this a credit or is this deductible against liability? How does that work?
So the per barrel credit, so Ms. Glover is going to talk about that in the next portion of the presentation, but the per barrel credits don't impact the corporate income tax.
Okay, thank you.
All right. And are there any other questions?
Please continue.
Okay. That's all I have for my portion of the presentation. So I'll turn it back over to Ms. Glover.
For the record, Colleen Glover again. We are moving on to the per barrel tax credit that is a component of the oil and gas production tax. We can move on to slide 12. The oil and gas production tax is in Title 43, Chapter 55 of the Alaska statutes. The statutes are very complicated and the regulations are quite extensive for this. We're going to focus on really talking about the per taxable barrel credits that are kind of the issue and what is impacted by Senate Bill 3002. The per taxable barrel credits only impact North Slope production, and there's two different per barrel credits. One is the GVR, which is the gross value reduction, which is the flat $5 per barrel credit for new production, as defined in Alaska Statute 4355-024I, commonly referred to sometimes as the 024I credit. The other is the non-GVR, which is the legacy production, and this is the sliding scale credit that goes from $8 to zero per barrel, and this is laid out in AS 4355-024J, and also commonly referred to as a 024J credit. It's this latter credit that is the one impacted by the proposed Senate Bill 3002.
Thank you, Ms. Glover. I have a quick question. So I keep hearing that we're paying out tax credits. Do we pay out tax credits, or could you, you know, and for the sake of the public at home, could you please explain to that how it works? Is it credit or deductible, or how do we pay out to the oil companies, or how does that work?
Chair Rivette, great question. This is not to be confused with those the tax credits that could earn cash that the state was buying back these credits, and I'll explain a little bit more in the next couple slides. It's really a part of the tax calculation, and they are not eligible for cash. So these are not being paid out to any taxpayer.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Glover. So just to be clear, this is so they're not called deductibles, they're called the credit, but actually this is just we're taxing them less, right, is what a credit means. Is that correct?
Chair Rivette, yeah, the credit is these credits, these per barrel credits, are a deduction in the calculation for what they end up having to pay for tax.
Okay, thank you so much. We have a question from Senator Machicki.
I just want to clarify, they're not paying less tax. The reason why per barrel was created, we actually increased the base rate, and what we did was provide some progressivity. The original amendment was $5. We raised the base rate from 25% to 35%, and then we placed a $5 per barrel credit. It's not a credit at all. What it did was created progressivity because $5 has a lot more effect at a lower price rate than it does a lower price than it does at a higher price. So it created a curve of progressivity. It was designed as an overall process and not as a credit. So I think it's been misunderstood significantly through the years. And I don't know if you want to comment on that or not. Ms. Glover, the change to the sliding scale changed that progressivity somewhat, but it is not that they're paying less tax. The original bill was a much lower tax rate. It was increased to 35% so that we could have some progressivity in the rate itself. Ms. Glover, did I get that correct, or do you want to touch on that at all?
Senator Machicki, yeah, you just really already talked about my slide 14, so thank you for helping out. But you were here during those days, but correct. So this goes back to the Senate Bill 21 days. The original proposal was a 25% tax rate with a flat $5 per barrel credit. And then it ended up changing to the 35% tax rate with the sliding scale credit, as Senator Machicki stated, to give some progressivity. So there's, you know, effectively a lower tax rate at lower prices, and then at once these per barrel credits expire at the $150, you would be at the 35% tax rate. And that was how the fiscal system was designed with SB 21.
Well, thank you, Ms. Glover. And I just wanted to make sure, you know, I think there's some confusion out there. Some folks believe that we're actually giving money. So I just wanted to be clear, and that doesn't work that way. Senator Machicki.
Slight correction, Ms. Glover. You said the original was 25% with a $5 per barrel credit. The original was 25% with no credit. The reason for the increase to 35% was for the progressivity that was delivered with the $5 per barrel. I just think the record should be correct. And I think you just misspoke. I know you understand the system.
It's a lot of progressivity. All right. Thank you very much, Senator Machicki. Any other questions? All right, Ms. Glover, please continue.
So moving on to slide 13, I thought it would be helpful to kind of talk about the whole production tax calculation at a high level, which is very difficult to do. But briefly, you can see from this slide where what's important for this bill is the gross value at the point of production, and that is the total production, and you subtract out the royalty barrels and the transportation costs. And the transportation cost is the cost from to get from the point of production to market, so typically marine shipping costs and pipeline tariffs. When you get to the production tax value, which is really the tax base for this tax, that is the gross value at the point of production, less the allowable lease expenditures that are allowed under current statute. At the production tax value, then there is a 35% tax that gets you to the net tax. There is also a kind of a side calculation on the left that is calculating the tax floor, It is not a separate tax. It is the tax floor. So the calculation for the tax floor is 4% of the gross value at the point of production. The taxpayer pays the higher of these two numbers, and then there are credits that can be applied against either of those tax numbers. You get to the credits. The primary credit is the per taxable barrel credit, which for most production cannot be used to reduce the production tax below the tax floor. And for purposes of this discussion, the sliding scale credits are applied against the net tax. And if used, the tax cannot go below the tax floor. So again, this is kind of an overly simplified diagram of the current production tax calculation for North Slope oil and gas production. It was just more for context to understand how these per barrel credits are in the overall calculation.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? Yes, Senator Machicki.
So I'm just looking at the slide, and then I'm looking at the bill. The sectional of the bill kind of is a little bit incorrect. The per barrel is not applied to the gross value at the point of production, the GVPP. It's applied to the net tax after least expenditure. So it's actually the production tax value where the credit is, where you determine which is the higher of the minimum and then where the credits are applied. Is that correct?
That is correct, Senator Machicki.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, moving on to slide 14. This is really what Senator Machicki had pointed out, that this is really a component of the overall oil and gas fiscal regime, and it was designed to create progressivity in the tax calculation. So at lower oil prices, there isn't a 35% tax, but there is a lower effective tax rate. And the amount of the credit is based on the gross value at the point of production. That then determines the total value of credits earned. And one thing to note was when SB 21 was debated and put into law, oil prices were quite a bit higher than they are today. They were in the hundreds, and that hasn't occurred for several years. You can see the kind of the impact of that. The credits, you know, the minimum credit, it starts at the $80. Moving on to slide 15, I think this is the current kind of brackets for these credits. You can see that at the gross value of anything less than 80, it's the $8. That goes down for every $10 change in the gross value, down to zero when the gross value is 150 or more. And one thing just to make sure people understand is that, so this is based on the gross value at the point of production per barrel. It is not the same as the ANS oil price. The ANS price is the market price, and you would deduct the transportation cost from that to get to the gross value at the point of production, or commonly referred to as the wellhead. Our transportation costs average around $9 to $10, so you can kind of rule of thumb would be ANS prices less $10 to kind of get the gross value.
Thank you. Please continue.
Moving on to slide 16, this is showing the historical amount of these per barrel credits that are actually used against a tax liability by all of the oil and gas taxpayers. Due to confidentiality, we have to report both of the per barrel credits together, so we could provide that information. So this is the usage for the last few years. This information is reported in both our annual fall and spring forecasts, as well as in our biennial indirect expenditure report. One thing to note on here that's really important is these numbers are not the same as what would be the revenue impact if these credits were eliminated. These are the value of the credits that are actually used and applied against the tax liability. If these were reduced or eliminated, taxpayers might have other tax credits or deductions that they could use to offset their tax liability. So it isn't necessarily a one-for-one. If these were repealed, it wouldn't necessarily mean this would be the amount of additional revenue to the state.
Thank you. Please continue.
And moving on to the next slide, that was all that Department of Revenue had prepared for you. I don't know if you want to answer some of the questions that came up earlier or move on to DNR so they can present their slides.
We're going to take a brief at ease very quickly. All right, we are back on the record. Do we have any questions for the Department of Revenue before we move into the DNR? No. All right. Please, whoever is going to present from the Department of Natural Resources, please put yourself on the record and begin.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Johnny Meza, and I work in the commercial section of the Division of Oil and Gas at the Department of Natural Resources. The purpose of the presentation that we have in front of you is to provide you with a summary of the revenues that the state of Alaska obtains in its capacity as resource owner and the effects that the proposed bill, SB 3002, might have on them. So with that, we can move to the next slide. Let's begin with a description of the revenues that the state of Alaska obtains in its capacity as resource owner. The most important source of revenue to the state in its role as resource owner comes from royalty. For example, the cumulative revenue as of early this year from royalty in the North Slope and the Cook Inlet is close to $30 billion, whereas revenues from net profit sharing amount to $1.2 billion. The ones related to cash bonus payments amount to $2.3 billion, and rental payments amount to $379 million. The royalty represents the share of gross production of oil and gas from the lease owed to the landowner. The typical royalty rates for the oil and gas leases issued by the state are 12.5%, although there are cases with royalty rates equal to 1/6 or 1/5 of the gross production. The royalty owed to the state is triggered upon severance from the lease and can be taken at the discretion of the state in value, meaning dollars, or in kind, meaning physical hydrocarbons. In general, cost of production are not considered in the monetary value of royalty. However, transportation costs and quality adjustments are. Therefore, royalty is assessed on a gross basis because the calculation of royalty does not consider any of the production costs and is different from the calculation of production tax that Ms. Glover described earlier, which is based on a net basis by considering the lease expenditures. Because the tax credits are not part of the calculation for royalties, the changes in Section 6 of this bill will not have a direct impact on royalty revenues. Moving on to net profit share. Earlier this year, the Department of Natural Resources provided a presentation with information on net profit share leases. These are a type of leases that, in addition to the royalty rate, contain an additional source of revenue to the state, which is the share of net profits generated by the lease from oil and gas production. The share of net profit from these leases are 30% for some, 40% for others, and as high as 79% for one lease in the Duck Island unit. In contrast with the case of royalty, where the state obtains revenue from each barrel of oil or cubic feet of gas produced, the revenues from net profit sharing come only after the development costs from that lease have been recovered with interest. By the revenues from the lease from the lease after deducting operating costs. In this way, the payment of royalty occurs every month that there is production, whereas the sharing of net profit occurs only once the net profit share lease has recovered its development costs. This could occur years after the first month of production. Therefore, there is a timing difference between these two types of revenues. In the calculation of the net profits being shared with the state, the regulations on net profit share leases determine an allowance for the potential contribution of the production from this lease to the overall production tax assessed on the lessee, on the producer. In this way, the so-called production tax lease allowance is another deduction to the revenues from the net profit share lease when calculating the net profits from this lease. In the calculation of this production tax lease allowance, we consider the tax credits that the taxable production from this lease might generate. Therefore, a change in the 024J tax credits as being proposed in the bill can have a direct impact on revenues from net profit sharing. We will discuss this in more detail in the next slides. Moving on to the next source of revenue to the state, bonus bid. The statutes require the DNR commissioner to offer oil and gas leases in a competitive way. As part of this offering, the DNR commissioner selects the bidding variable, typically the cash bonus, which is an upfront payment to acquire the lease. In this way, the bidder offering the highest cash bonus is awarded the oil and gas lease, which contains, among other things, a royalty provision, the duration of the lease, and a rental payment. Given the nature of this source of revenue, the proposed change in the bill, Section 6, does not have any impact here. And lastly, the lease rental payment. They are done in an annual basis and are most evident while the lease is not yet producing. Once that happens, this source of revenue gets substituted by the royalty revenues. Our rental payments are typically set at $10 per acre. And given, again, this nature of source of revenue, the proposed changes in the bill related to Section 6 does not have any impact here. And with that, I will pause here in case there are any questions before moving to the next slide.
Thank you, Mr. Mazar. Are there questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Keel. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mazar, can you give us a sense of scale, an order of magnitude of what this impact would be on net profit share lease payments to the state?
Senator Keel, through the chair, I have that in my next slide.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Stevens.
Well, as always, this is a very complex tax structure. Do most states follow this, oil-producing companies follow this complexity, or are there simpler ways to tax the industry?
Senator, through the chair, as far as I'm aware, I believe that there were this type of net profit share leases in the for federal oil and gas leases at some point, but to my knowledge, I think Alaska is unique in that sense.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mazza. Please continue.
Certainly. Moving on to slide three, and in the first bullet point there, we will discuss this order of magnitude type of impact that this bill might have on revenues from net profit share leases. But before commenting on that, we want to say that we roughly estimate this reduction in the dollar per barrel tax credit as proposed in the bill, and that it will generate a reduction of $500,000 from net profits shared with the state from the net profit share leases in the North Slope. We want to emphasize that when arriving at this estimate, we had to make a series of simplifications and assumptions. The main purpose of this exercise is not necessarily to forecast the precise impact of this change, but rather to get a sense of the order of magnitude of this impact versus what could be expected to be generated in terms of additional revenues resulting from this bill, coming from the revenues related to the production tax. In this way, the $500,000 reduction in net profit share revenues apply only to a subset of the net profit share leases that exist in the state, which amount to 26, and they are located in the North Slope. Of these 26 net profit share leases, only 12 of them have got to the point where they have recovered their development costs and therefore have shared their net profits with the state. In contrast, the total leases in production in the North Slope, and thus contributing to the revenues from production tax, amount to 461. So that's to give a sense of comparison in terms of magnitude. As we mentioned before, there is a deduction representing the potential contribution from the taxable production from this type of lease, the net profit share lease, to the overall production tax assessed on the lessee. We call this the production tax lease allowance. And this is a deduction to the revenues generated by the net profit share lease. Therefore, a higher production tax lease allowance means a lower profit being shared with the state. So in this calculation, we consider the contribution of the taxable production from this lease, the net profit share lease, to the oil and gas production tax credits, like the O24J tax credit. As a result, if there is a lower tax credit as being proposed by the bill, then the allowance for this production tax related to the net profit share lease would be higher, which in turn translates into a lower profit being shared with the state. And that is the concept behind the estimated impact of $500,000 reduction in net profit share revenues. But as we mentioned earlier, this negative impact only occurs when the net profit share lease has recovered its development costs. And we mentioned that only 12 out of the 26 have gotten to that point. But also the changes in the tax credits become significant when in the calculation of this production tax for the lease, we see that they are above the minimum tax because that's the threshold for the application of this particular so-called tax credit. The other effect that a reduction in these O24J tax credits has on net profit sharing is that they will likely delay the date by which the net profit share lease recovers its development costs, because when the lease is not yet ready to share their profits, the revenues in excess of operating costs become smaller due to the higher production tax lease allowance in the absence of the proposed changes. And with that, I will pause if there are any questions on this slide.
Questions? Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meza, is there an element that corporate income tax plays in this calculation, or is it only on the production tax side?
Senator Keel, through the chair, no, corporate income tax does not affect the calculation of net profit sharing for these leases.
Thank you.
Senator Machicki.
Mr. Meza, I realize that DNR is very focused on royalty, But this is an interesting example. I think it's interesting. The effect is definitely interesting, but it's relatively minuscule in the grand scheme of things when you consider tax rates, oil tax rates, right? Would you agree with that?
Senator Mishiki, through the chair, yes, the estimate that we provide there, $500,000 per year, comes from the subset of net profit share leases, which amount to 12 out of the 26, versus the amount of leases, 461, that contribute to production tax. So that gives you kind of a order of magnitude comparison in the impact versus the proposed additional revenues from production tax.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to put it in perspective. This is interesting and not an effect I had considered on the net profit leases, but I just wanted to help put it in perspective for the committee.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, Mr. Meza.
Thank you. And now we can proceed with slide 4, which is the last one. And in this slide, we provide a simplified example of how this proposed change in the bill, section 6, related to the tax credits, could reduce the net profits being shared with the state from a net profit share lease. We begin with the table on the left side, which represents a case of a net profit share lease producing 1,000 barrels per day, having a royalty rate of 1/6, and sharing 40% of the net profits once it has recovered its development costs. In this case, we're going to assume that that has already happened. If the price of oil is at $65 per barrel, and that the transportation costs amount to $10 per barrel, represented by the pipeline tariffs and marine transportation, we find that the value of a barrel of oil at the field is $55 per barrel. Since royalty and net profit share payments are assessed each month, we consider the monthly value of production from this lease, which would be 30,000 barrels. With a royalty rate of 1/6, we have that the production net of royalty for the lessee or producer is 25,000 barrels, or 1/5 of the total production. Therefore, the gross revenue to the lessee becomes $1,375,000 for that month. Now we move to the tables on the right side, and let's begin with the one on the upper right portion of the slide. The scenario with the lower production tax. Here we're also assuming that the net profit share lease has already recovered its development costs, as we said earlier, and therefore can begin to share its net profits with the state. From the revenue to the lessee, we just calculated, we deduct the operating costs and the allowance for production tax generated by the taxable production from this specific lease. After deducting these amounts, we obtain a net revenue, or also called net profit, of $525,000, of which we take 40% to be shared with the state, and that is the revenue coming from net profit sharing. What happens then when, as a result of our reduction in the 024J tax credits, the allowance for production tax associated with this lease increases? In this example, we assume that the allowance for production tax increases from $100,000 to $200,000. We see that this translates into a reduction of net profit from $525,000 to $425,000. And thus, of the amount being shared with the state. It is worth noting that this example is done for demonstration purposes only and are not necessarily based on any specific case of the 26 net profit share leases we have in the North Slope. And with that, my presentation concludes, but I will pause here for any questions from the committee.
Questions? questions? Yes, Senator Machicki.
I just have one question, Mr. Meza. I understand you did it for illustration reasons, and I find it fascinating. But in a scenario such as a per barrel credit reduction, you're not going to be doubling. I can't see the case where you'd be doubling a production tax. And if possible, it'd be in a very limited set of circumstances. I don't think that's likely a thing. So your 100 to 200 is more likely 100 to something much lower. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator Michiki, through the chair. That was just for the arithmetic exercise. But you're correct. When we talk about magnitude, the likelihood that of the increase of the production tax lease allowance corresponding to this net profit share lease will unlikely be twice the amount as it was originally due to the reduction in the tax credits. So you're correct.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I understood the illustrative purpose of the slide. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Meza, does the Department of Natural Resources believe this will affect production in any way, and if so, and how?
Senator Rivak, if your question is related to long-term production, if that's the case, we have talked throughout the presentation about direct impacts. And if your question is directed into that type of scenario, one can make a case that there could be indirect impacts related to if there is a higher production tax burden, it may impact the profitability over the long term of certain fields. So that exercise we have not yet done, but certainly one can argue that it will be possible.
Well, thank you, Mr. Meza. Yeah, I remember not too long ago you were here presenting the net profit share lease bill. And I think that was the kind of the whole premise of that bill, is that we're thwarting production because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was pretty much the I don't know if it was the official stance by the Department of Resources, but the whole premise there was that, and I believe it was the administration's bill, was that we're not producing these leases because the state's take in these net profit shares leases is so high that it's not economical. Isn't that what you were arguing or presenting, rather?
Senator Rivak, that's correct. The purpose of the bill was to, for those specific cases of fields that were getting close to a marginal situation, compromise in its profitability to the point of being close to abandonment, shutting down, or on the other case, to not even occur in the first place, we were proposing that changes in the net profit share rate for net profit share leases could potentially help for those fields that have net profit share leases, make the change towards economic production that wouldn't otherwise occur.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mason. So then it is true from the perspective of the department that increasing taxes would have a negative long-term effect, or very, very well could have. Is that true or no?
Senator Rivak, one can reasonably argue that an additional burden on the production tax could have an indirect impact over the long term and potentially affect that marginal situation for certain fields. Now, I will also have to say that with respect to this proposed change in credits, it is important to note that there is a certain price range where it makes a difference when a company is above the minimum tax value or not. So it is also important to mention that.
What is that price range?
I would say, and of course, I would defer to the Department of Revenue to provide an official estimate for that, but without knowing the costs of all the lessees in the North Slope, we have to take into account not only the gross value at the point of production, which is the price of the field, but also the other element in that comparison, which is the production tax value, which takes into account the deduction of the lease expenditures from the production from all fields. Okay. So it could vary depending on what assumptions we make for those costs.
Thank you very much, Mr. Meza. Any other questions?
I have just one.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
Mr. Meza, I understand the value of the net profit share program, and I understand that these are all marginal wells. If there was a change at some point to the per barrel or some other change to the tax regime, would your suggestion be that those net profit share leases were exempted from a change that would perhaps put them over the edge of feasibility for future production?
Senator Michiki, through the chair, the regulations on net profit share leases refer to a deduction related to the existing structure of the production tax system in place. So from that perspective, whatever the changes occur from a production tax in the statute will likely be reflected in the accounting of these revenues from net profit share leases, because that's what the regulations refer to.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Meza. We appreciate you being here. And I do have, if we have our folks from Department of Revenue online, I have one real quick question, and we'll wrap this up here. I think the presenter said we estimated about $110 million annually from the per barrel, $67 million from the corporate income tax, and $18 million from the motor fuels tax. Is that about right? What is the aggregate of all this in terms of revenues to the state that the Department of Revenue believes that this bill will produce?
So, Chair Reback, I apologize that you haven't got our fiscal note yet. I think it's in transit. So for fiscal year 2022, our estimate is about $79 million. And our estimate for, I think, 2025, which was quoted by the bill sponsor, is 391. We're not sure exactly where the numbers came from the bill sponsor. We believe it might be from a presentation that revenue gave to the fiscal working group. And if that's the case, there are some differences between those numbers that we have presented and what actual Senate Bill 3002 impacts are. Some of it was timing. Of the three components to Senate Bill 3002, the one with the corporate income tax expanding to pass-through entities, the proposal or the proposed options that were provided to the fiscal working group that had an effective date of January 2021. So the fiscal year 2022 revenue impact was assuming this retroactivity. So that is why that component was a lot larger than it is with actual impact from Senate Bill 3002. This expands to other entities. What was provided by revenue to the fiscal working group, the pass-through only applied to oil and gas entities, not all entities, and it didn't have that $4 million threshold. So there are some differences between what Senate Bill 3002 does versus what I think the information the bill sponsor was using. The numbers are very similar to what revenue had presented to the fiscal working group, so we're just making that assumption. That's where we got it, but we don't know for sure.
Thank you, Ms. Glover. Real quick, do we know when that fiscal note might be forthcoming?
Chair Reback, I believe any time. I think it's tied up in the system and how it gets transmitted that I'm not involved in, but I know it's been submitted, and I think there was some error somehow in the upload, so it should be anytime.
Thank you very much, Ms. Glover. Senator Machicki?
Yeah, Ms. Glover, do you know if that was, are those updated on an expected fall forecast, or is that fiscal note on the spring forecast that was much lower than expected?
Senator Machicki, the fiscal note that you'll be receiving soon is based on the spring forecast. And just thank you for bringing that up. Another kind of significant difference, too, with the numbers that were presented to that fiscal working group, we had a July Alaska North Slope price projected increase, and that also, you know, with a higher price forecast, that would change the impacts from these bills for both the per barrel credit and the pass-through corporate income tax. So that was another difference between what we presented to the fiscal working group versus what you will see in the fiscal note when you get it.
I had one brief one.
Yeah, please, Senator Machicki.
So, Mr. Stickle, I know you're just listening, and I don't need you to come on, but could you please provide the chair with perhaps the amount of companies that may be affected by the $4 million threshold, and what, if you have any information on what that revenue may potentially look like? We're operating kind of blind on that $4 million. Since it's no longer, doesn't seem to be oil and gas, it seems to be just a threshold on the corporate level. Net income, it'd be nice if you have any information to share with us whatsoever, and that could just be an email to the chair and he can distribute it to us. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. We would appreciate any information that you have on what corporations would be effective, just like Senator Machicki. Please, Mr. Stickle, can you provide that?
Sure, yeah, this is Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Alaska Department of Revenue. We would be happy to respond and follow up with whatever information we can. As far as the impact on non-petroleum corporations and the $4 million exemption in the legislation before you, that is not information that we do have directly available, which is in the forthcoming fiscal note. You'll see that we have not attempted to put a revenue estimate to the non-petroleum side of things. We have come up with a revenue estimate for the oil and gas side of things, but we'll put some effort into it and get you whatever we can on that.
Thank you. And really, anything related to the assumption that led to 900 corporations in Alaska, even assumptions, we'd love to hear what was, where this kind of came from. So any information would be great.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A month ago on 810, we had a fiscal options consideration presentation from the governor, and the modifying the sliding scale was on there, requiring oil and gas pass-through entities to pay corporate income tax was on there, and increased motor fuels, excluding aviation, among several others. I'm looking just at the one for the per barrel credit reduction on the production tax revenue, and it refers to a bill in the description, and it also refers to revenues could increase production tax revenues by 110 to 440 depending on price, production, and anticipated company spending during the period. Is there an actual fiscal note for this somewhere? For this presentation that was given to the fiscal policy work group on the 10th of August.
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, that was based on some analysis that we've done, and that was using the July ANS price increase. We can check into getting you the information on that particular scenario.
And then I guess the same would go for the motor fuels tax. It looks like the administration used the motor fuels tax that's in House Finance Committee right now, House Bill 104. And then the other one is the expanding the corporate income tax to oil and gas pass-through entities, which is slightly different than what we have in 3002. I'd like to just see those numbers. That would be helpful for us, I think, as a starting point.
Yeah, if you could please send that to our office, we'd be very grateful, Ms. Glover. We'll distribute that to the committee members. Any other questions? All right, thank you all for your patience. This is longer than we usually go. Thank you all for your testimony and all your work for the state. We appreciate it. We're going to wrap up. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow. Please, everybody, be advised. That may change. We thank you very much for your patience and your flexibility. We do have some consultants working on some estimates related to this bill. We'd very much like to hear from them, so upon their completion, we may have to flex a little bit. So we'll let you know as far ahead of time as possible. Again, thank you for your patience. Our meeting is now adjourned at 6:07.